Hello. This week, as the Philadelphia Orchestra prepares for concerts featuring music from Night of the Mayas, we hear from conductor Miguel Harth Bedoya and percussionist Angela Zader-Nelson. Silvestre Rivalta's seldom performed work includes many unusual percussive elements. Susan Lewis considers the Opera Company of Philadelphia's new production of Engelbert Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel. We visit Bartram's Garden to speak with artist Mark Dion. He'll be retracing a four-year voyage made by William Bartram in the 1770s. Along the way, he'll mail back found objects, which will then become the subject of a sculpture he'll create. And Jason Pfeiffer takes us behind the scenes as a cast member in Villanova University's production of Mother Courage and Her Children. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Violinist, conductor, and composer Silvestre Revueltas was born in Mexico at the turn of the 20th century and grew up amidst civil unrest and cultural change. The Mexican Revolution, sparked in 1910, transformed the country from a dictatorship to a constitutional government friendly to the arts. As a young man, Revueltas studied in Texas and Chicago before returning to Mexico to eventually work with leading composer Carlos Chavez at the National Conservatory of Music and the Mexico Symphony Orchestra. There he taught violin, conducted, and composed. In the 30s, he composed prolifically and became increasingly involved in politically inspired art. The 1939 film Night of the Mayas was one of a number of film scores he composed for the burgeoning Mexican film industry. The film, based on a novel by Antonio Mediz Bolo, follows the life of a young couple who leave modern society to live in a Mayan village where they encounter indigenous culture, white settlers, and natural calamity. Next weekend, the Philadelphia Orchestra performs Revueltas, The Night of the Mayas, in two concerts conducted by Miguel Harth Bedoya.
The Night of the Mayas was not conceived as a concert piece, but it was created as a film score for the film of the same title. Produced in 1939, as the outbreak of the Second World War starts, and it's a film that deals with the fight and the clash of cultures. Interestingly enough, the film has not been successful to have lived longer than its time, but the music has. And it was Limantour, a colleague of Revueltas, who actually extracted various parts of the film score and put it together so that it works as a symphony, kind of in four movements of about a half an hour long, and bringing the best out of it. The most important part, I believe, in listening to this music is in the perspective of the mix of cultures. In did the Europeans discover us, or did we encounter the Europeans? It depends whose side of the world tells the story, the same story. And this is what happens in The Night of the Mayas. You know, you have basically Revueltas' view in music making of how this develops. And certainly there has been a huge influence of, musically speaking, of both worlds into creating fusion of music. Every place by now has had so much mixture of musical elements from different cultures, and that's what comes out in The Night of the Mayas. Revueltas incorporates native percussion instruments such as the tumcul, such as, the sonajas, and, the tumcul is a log drum and some, as we call, Indian drums, different bass drums, and mixes them with modern instruments such as the xylophone. Now, however, the xylophone is closer to the marimba, and the marimba was brought up by the Africans to the Americas, you know, as they were slaves. So that already made its way into native music. And percussion is like our heartbeat in all throughout Latin America. I mean, we really cannot live without percussion. Now, it doesn't mean we need a percussion group, but the flow of percussion or the presence of percussion is vital to our music. Now, also lack of percussion is part of that. And so Revueltas has developed a great deal of percussion usage and writing. However, in the development of this particular work, various people have added to this score so much that now there are sections of improvised nature, which also was, you know, very normal thing to have in Latin American music, and that just took its own life. So the last movement basically brings out the best of the percussion section, and that never sounds the same in every orchestra or in every performance. So that we'll have to see how it develops, and it adds a great deal of spontaneity to the work as well. How audiences behave during concert music is something that I'm very fascinated about. And unfortunately, as a conductor, unless you have some sitting around the stage, you know, we can never fully see how the audience behaves or acts. And I certainly like in any way that as long as listening to music or watching to music is never interrupted, I think that everybody should feel completely free to have their bodies and minds react to as they feel. I mean, certainly this music has huge range of everything, emotion through subtleties, through ugly moments even. I mean, painful moments, short, but they are there. And I think we should just let loose and, you know, let the music take you.
Miguel Harth Bedoya. And as he mentioned, the Night of the Mayas features many unusual percussive elements. To get a better sense of these, I recently visited the percussion room backstage at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall, where orchestra percussionist Angela Zator Nelson gave me a brief tour and a demonstration of some of the instruments used in Night of the Mayas.
So we just have here just a regular maraca, mm-hmm. or as you can call it, shaker. Which is really predominant, I think, in the second movement. Just a constant pattern.
Are there any peculiar time signatures in this piece? Is there anything that you really have to use a different part of your brain with?
Sure, definitely. In the, again, the second movement, which I was just playing on the maracas, it constantly, I think, is going between 5-8 and 6-8. So it's a lot of counting. Even though it's a constant rhythmic background, you still have to count all the measures, because if you don't, then you're in trouble.
Can I ask, because it's an obvious question, who are your neighbors here at the Kimmel Center, and do they ever bang on the walls?
Our neighbor, luckily, the timpani room is over there, so he doesn't mind. And I think it's empty space on the other side, so it works out
guessed.
Really well.
And that immediately says South America, doesn't
Definitely.
It?
Definitely.
Are there other things that are really evocative in terms of either a sound or an instrument or the way you play a particular instrument that immediately say we're not in the realm of Western classical music here? Is there anything in this piece that immediately people are going to want to be, dancing in the aisles?
Definitely the kungas and the bongos. Again, hand percussion, which we generally, I can't think, there are not many pieces that we need to use hand drums for.
So do you have any of those, or can you show us what those are?
So the kunga is the larger of the drums. The bongos are the small hand drums. That will be going on in the Night of the Mayans.
Philadelphia Orchestra percussionist Angela Zator Nelson. In a program that also features works by Ravel and Liszt, The Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Miguel Harth Bedoya, performs Silvestre Revueltas, The Night of the Mayas, next Friday and Saturday at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall. Both concerts begin at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Grim fairy tales, despite their darker themes, can be deceptively child-friendly, while opera, despite its lyric melodies, is commonly considered to be adult fare. This week, the Opera Company of Philadelphia retells the tale of Hansel and Gretel in a production geared to adults and children alike. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis reports on this production, which joins 19th-century German repertoire with the visual artistry of a beloved contemporary children's book author and illustrator.
Engelbert Humperdinck's opera Hansel and Gretel began, as so many things do, with a family favor for the holidays. In 1890, the German composer's sister asked him to create music for folk songs she had written based on the fairy tale, so that her daughters could perform them for family and friends. He obliged with a 16-song Singspiel, literally a play with songs. The folk songs were, and are, catchy.
I can even sing some of them.
Robert Driver is artistic director of the Opera Company of Philadelphia.
Einmal hin, einmal her, rundherum, es ist nicht schwer.
People liked his work so well that Humperdinck was inspired to create a full-scale opera. In it, he added soaring arias and lush orchestration, learned from his studies with Richard Wagner in the early 1880s.
This, to me, is really a Wagnerian role.
This is the fifth time Jennifer Roederer has sung The Witch in Hansel and Gretel.
It uses all of my range from low to high, and it takes a lot of stamina.
The opera requires singers with stamina and performing space with lots of room. Artistic director Robert Driver says the 62 musicians in the pit are about all that fit. The sets include, among other things, about 38 large pieces of scenery, or drops, waiting suspended above the stage.
I don't think this company has ever dealt with so many flying drops coming in and out. The fantasy of it is just over the top. Wonderful.
While this type of scenery harkens back to the Academy's early days, the drops in this production have a distinctly modern flair. They look like giant storybook illustrations, with images recognizable to fans of Where the Wild Things Are and other books by Maurice Sendak, who created these sets and costumes in 1997 for Houston Grand Opera. In other operas, Richard St. Clair may design costumes. In this production, he is costume director, working to make sure that every costume remains true to Maurice Sendak's designs.
A lot of what we did was, with the Sendak illustrations of the costumes in front of us, try and put them back the way they were originally designed before they've been worn like 100 times since then. And then a couple of our people were different sizes than the costumes that came were, so we built those costumes from scratch, but slavishly recapturing the drawings of Maurice Sendak and trying to go back to the original designs again.
Sendak's touch is everywhere, and Robert Driver says the production is infused with the author's sense of fantasy.
He has got so many wonderful ideas. You will find when the witch puts a spell on the kids, it's very funny. Very funny. I never would have thought it, I have to admit.
Hocus, hocus, bonus, hocus.
As costume director, St. Clair says his goal is to make the production look like living illustrations by Maurice Sendak.
We built a pair of angel wings. The person from my crew who actually made the wings tried to capture his line quality on each feather so that it looks like he drew it. And that's how the sets look. The sets really look like Maurice Sendak actually drew every last element.
It's easier to make a large canvas drop look like a drawing than a costume, which of course is inhabited by a real live person, like Jennifer Roederer, who sings The Witch. She says a great costume can help her get into the role.
This will be my fifth production of Hansel and Gretel, and it's the first time I've been a really creepy, scary-looking witch. I have been green before, but she was sort of a sexy green.
Although this is her fifth Hansel and Gretel, it's Roederer's first Maurice Sendak version. She says in building her characters visually, she's had to find large, simple actions.
Because the set is so alive and the set is so complex and visually rich, to be against that, you really have to play with that set. Otherwise, you'll get lost in it. And yet you also want to draw attention to the set. You don't want to try to compete with the set because you won't win.
If any character can compete with the set, perhaps it is the character of the witch. She is both funny and dark, and in this production, outfitted with a costume unlike that of any other witch.
With the skirt and the apron and this funny little top and this hat that looks like a strawberry. When you saw it all in pieces, it didn't really make all that much sense. But when we got the sketch in front of us and we got her all dressed, I was like, oh, this is what it's supposed to do. And in the fitting room then, she started doing this cackling singing that she does as the witch when she got in this, because she just felt like the witch all of a sudden.
Is Hansel and Gretel a children's opera? Hardly, say both Robert Driver and Jennifer Roederer.
I've heard people say, oh, Hansel and Gretel, it's a kiddie opera. I lose my mind because it's not a kiddie opera. It's very much an adult opera that children enjoy.
Kids accept opera completely. They have no preconceived notions of opera.
So the familiar tale is once again told, with lush music, darkness and humor, and the Sendak artistry that suggests we pull up a pillow, turn down the lights, and let our imaginations run where the wild things may be.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Engelbert Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel is at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia through Sunday, November 25th. This is Creatively Speaking on WRTI. I'm Jim Cotter. For the next section of our program, we've left the studio and traveled to West Philadelphia to Bartram's Garden, the historic home of John Bartram and his son William. We're in one of the barns. Bartram, of course, the explorer and botanist who lived in the 1700s, and most famous for his discovery of the Franklinia tree, which he named for his friend Benjamin Franklin. The reason we're here today is because of an artistic endeavor, and normally in this program we get to see the results of artistic endeavors. We're rarely there when the concept is being launched, and with me is artist Mark Dion, who is following in the footsteps of William Bartram, starting out today and traveling to North Florida by foot, horse, boat, and other methods.
And car, yes. I think primarily this part of the journey will be a car expedition.
What form will the art that's produced from this endeavor take?
Well, what we're doing is we have some purpose-built furniture that's going to be, it's very inspired by what already exists here at Bartram's Gardens, and that will be made to hold a collection of things, objects, both natural and artificial. So we'll send things back and we'll fill those cabinets with the curiosities and the natural wonders that we encounter in our trip.
When the endeavor is finished, and I should ask actually how long it's going to take?
Well, we're doing three-week excursions. So each one will focus on a different region and also different techniques. So this first time we're going to be flitting about a little bit. So we'll be hitting a lot of the hot spots on Bartram's Trail and spreading ourselves out a bit thin. I think the trip we'll do in April, we're going to be very stationary and see which of these is sort of more conducive for acquiring the data we need.
And when it's all finished, you'll have all these found objects. Will you then rearrange them? You say you're sending them back here to Bartram's Garden. Presumably somebody else is putting them in these display cases. Will you then come and create a work at the end of the expedition?
Yeah, that's right. I think at each of the end of those 3 week periods, we'll come back and organize the material that we've generated, figure out where that goes. And some of the cabinets aren't yet finished, so I think that's something that I really have to do. And a big part of this is an experiment of trying to imagine this genre of travel, which has been primarily a literary genre and certainly a pictorial genre, but not a sculptural genre. So as a person who works with physical things, with material culture, this is a way of really exploring the possibilities of taking that genre into the techniques and methodologies of sculpture.
Mark Dion. His journal entries, as well as photos and other records of his journey, are being recorded on a new website, markdionsbartramstravels.com. Although he died over 50 years ago, the legacy of the German playwright and poet Bertolt Brecht remains strong, particularly within the theatre world, because of his theories about drama and his innovative writing style. Villanova University in suburban Philadelphia is now staging one of Brecht's best-known works, Mother Courage and Her Children, and WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer happens to be one of the actors in the production. This marks a return to the stage for Jason, something he says was unexpected.
It was an impulsive thing. One Monday evening, about 2 months ago, an email landed in my inbox asking me to read for a part in Mother Courage. It was from a theater professor at Villanova who knew someone who knew someone who knew me and my love for theater. Before I knew it, 14 other actors and myself were gathered around a table with our director, Sean Kirshner, discussing the logistics of staging this 1939 play.
So this one, I think there's a feeling like everyone's trying hard to convince themselves that the war's a good thing. And that's sort of what we want to try to convey.
The last time I was in a full-scale play was about 3.5 years ago, when I played the character of Tom in a Temple production of The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams. Though I have a good deal of background in theater, I worked for a couple years as an actor and studied some theater in college. When I finished The Glass Menagerie play, I thought that would probably be the last show I'd be in. I much enjoy acting, but I was ready to move in other professional directions. So I'm a little surprised to find myself on stage again. But after covering theater for 3 years as a reporter, I'm intrigued to be looking at the theater process anew, from the inside out. Set during the 30 Years' War that devastated what we now know as Germany in the early 1600s, the Villanova play centers on Anna Fearling, nicknamed Mother Courage, who makes her living from the war. Villanova's selection of Mother Courage for this season is in large part to the credit of Joanna Rote, a theater professor at the school for nearly 25 years. Rote suggested producing the play because she hoped to one day perform the title role.
I decided that there are perhaps in the canon maybe 4 or 5 roles that I must play before I die. And Mother Courage popped up as one of them.
Simultaneously, another Villanova theater professor, Sean Kirshner, submitted Mother Courage as a play to consider for this year, with interest in directing the work himself. The two separate proposals to produce the piece secured the Brecht drama as the linchpin of the university's theater season. One of the first steps of mounting a play, especially one so deeply rooted in history, is to take some time to understand the context of the story and its intentions. One of our first sessions together as a cast consisted of an extensive presentation about Brecht, the 30 Years' War, and the horrors of war in general. With the history in mind, director Sean Kirshner says there's a reason the nearly 70-year-old play continues to resonate today.
This play is unfortunately almost always relevant because it's a war play.
An anti-war play at that. Kirshner says though Brecht set the play during the 30 Years' War in the 1600s, a conflict that decimated Germany, he very much had the experience of World War I and the approach of World War II in mind as he wrote.
He wanted to use realities of that war as a warning about war in general.
As actors, however, our goal is not to get wrapped up in what the message of the play might be, but rather tell the story. I play several smaller roles in the play, an ordnance officer, a sergeant, and a lieutenant. But with all the logistics involved in piecing the production together, I was kept busy. I rarely had a free evening or weekend.
So in a sense, you freeze to address her. What I remember or have marked in my script is that I'm center stage, essentially.
During the first month or so, our rehearsals took place in a studio space, with the stage dimensions taped off on a creaky floor. For weeks, we concentrated on getting our lines down pat and mapping out the basic movement of the characters. This stage of the rehearsal process takes quite a bit of imagination, because you don't have a deep sense of what the set, costumes, and show as a whole will look like. And then there's learning the music.
1, 2, 3, 4, nobody tries to tell me this is different. War's a business and it's just like all the rest.
While Mother Courage isn't a musical, per se, it does have a number of songs, some of which involve the whole cast. And when there's a large group singing, it's hard to stay together and easy to get sloppy. Although getting the music right was laborious at times, it afforded me one of my favorite parts of the rehearsal period, listening to the band jam during breaks. The music of the production is under the direction of Jay Ansel, a fiddler, guitarist, and composer hired from outside the Villanova community. The involvement of people like Ansel in Mother Courage is one of the more striking aspects of the production. It's a university show made up of predominantly graduate and undergraduate students, but faculty member Joanna Rote plays the lead. So Villanova hired two local acting veterans of similar age and experience, Tim Moyer and Jean Taruso, to play the love interest opposite Mother Courage. This kind of casting is not unheard of for Villanova, but it doesn't happen every show. Sean Kirshner reasons that if there's ever a time to cast age appropriate, it's now.
Because we thought it might be a little silly to have a 25-year-old student in a beard trying to flirt with Mother Courage.
Teaming up young actors with seasoned performers provides valuable experiences for all involved, according to Joanna Rote, but especially students.
It gives the students an opportunity to work beyond their range or beyond their expectations, perhaps to be inspired. There they are, and they need to rise to the occasion.
Rising to the occasion is something we all had to do, especially in the last few weeks of rehearsals. I thought I had remembered what those final weeks are like, with run-throughs of the entire show, when set pieces and finished props are added. But I found that my memory had faded a little. I was reminded it's truly an exciting part of the process, so much of what was previously left to the imagination becomes fleshed out. But it's also an especially stressful and exhausting stage of rehearsals. If something's not working, the pressure's on to get it right. It can't be reworked the next week. And then there's the last major hurdle, tech rehearsals. This is where the lighting, scene change logistics, and costumes are implemented. For the actor, this is one of the most tedious parts of rehearsal. Though entirely necessary, tech rehearsals involve a lot of standing around. It's very stop and go. I must have heard our stage manager, Josh Hoover, say 100 times.
Hold, please.
But after all the last-minute adjustments and tweaking, opening night finally comes. The product is complete. Though it grows in small ways over the course of a run, the show plan is essentially locked in. The tricky part is executing the plan night in and night out without losing focus. Taking part in a play again, from the first rehearsals to actual performances, I relearned how complicated and difficult it really is to stage a show. It takes long hours and the cooperation of many to pull it off. With a renewed empathy for those on the other side of the footlights, I suspect that from now on I'll be a little more circumspect in my judgment of the theatrical offerings of others. In the meantime, at the Arts and Culture Desk, I'm Jason Pfeiffer, or in the case of Bertolt Brecht's play, the ordnance officer, the sergeant, and the lieutenant. Mother Courage and Her Children runs through December 2nd at Villanova University. Book early to avoid disappointment.
And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Tracy Gallagher, Shannon Grant, and Lauren Saul. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.